before I start, let me first just make mention, I don't think this is either a positive or a negative, it's simply a statement of fact. The course that I'm giving, I owe much credit to Dr. Moshe Bernstein, who also teaches a couple of sections of the course. The syllabus is heavily, I mean, it really started out as is with some, a few changes, and a few things that are in the process of changing, but basically it's the same syllabus and the same reader, and the lectures are somewhat different, but nonetheless the content is largely the same. The entire course, with the exception of 2 weeks, and sometimes that gets cut down before the midterm, maybe a week and a half, is going to be based upon sources that are found in Chazal. Chazal and Rishonim, Gemaras, Mishnayis, Bablis, Yerushalmis, Midrashi Halacha, Midrashi Agada, and Rishonim. Typically speaking, the classic Parshanim of the medieval period, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, Rashbam, and a few others. I should, with the exception of 2 weeks, those 2 weeks, which will come at the end of the first half of the course, will be on ancient Near East, something that some of you maybe encountered in a high school history course, but probably have not studied before. I will tell you up front that some of the material that we will study is going to bother you. It's going to disturb you, we'll call it religiously, hashkafically, based upon things that you were taught previously, whether it was taught in Eretz Yisrael or whether you picked it up in high school or earlier than that. I will make a few comments about that, however. The material that's going to disturb you, that should disturb you the most or might disturb you the most, is going to be Chazal. It's not going to be the other material that we do. There is a tendency that people have to ignore sources in Chazal that either they don't understand or it doesn't fit with their worldview. But these are not off the beaten track sources generally. They're Gemaras. They're quite well known sources and important sources. And if you're bothered by them, so they're sort of two possibilities you have. First possibility is to modify the assumptions that you brought in with you when you started reading those sources in Chazal. And if Rashi or the Gemara says something differently than you assume to be the case, so you can modify that assumption. That's one possibility. The second possibility, which I also welcome, is that you can challenge my reading of the particular source. If you think that the Gemara doesn't say what it says, or Rashi doesn't say what I say he says, or Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, so then you should feel free to challenge it. But I think those are the two possibilities when you confront sources that are a little bit discomforting, something that you haven't encountered before, and conflict with things that you have either been taught or assume. The only response that I don't want to hear, and I occasionally have had this not in class but out of class when students have engaged in extended discussions, is that, well, we don't know how to read the sources. In other words, we can't render judgment between what I was taught or what I thought and what we, you know, read here. If you can't read the sources after we've been through them, so you probably don't belong in MYP/BMP, because one of the presumably prerequisites is that you'd be able to read Mishnaic Hebrew and Biblical Hebrew. But I don't think it should have to come to that. What I ask is that when you find sources in Chazal that conflict what you thought to be the case, that you should read them carefully. Excuse me. And then consider whether or not, in fact, it conflicts with what you've been taught before, what you've thought, or not. Now, I open with sort of a very broad question. The course, I don't know how they title it officially, Introduction to Bible, Introduction to Biblical Exegesis, it's not clear. But the question is, why do we study Tanakh? Why bother? Any thoughts on the subject? Yes, your name again?
Common?
So your argument is that it's part of Talmud Torah. Okay. Magisa b'yom v'layla, so there's Torah Shebichsav, there is Torah Shebal Peh, and therefore it should be studied. Now, yes. Yes.
If the basis for everything else that we had, the definition of Gemara, any other literature that we had, Tanakh is the basis for it. So we wouldn't be able to learn that and have our, you know, all the mitzvahs or abundance or whatever it is without the Tanakh.
Let me ask you a question. You think in, I picked this not as criticizing, but just a stereotype. Do you think in B'nai Brak they study very much Tanakh?
No.
Do you think that there's anybody there who can talk about Mitzvahs D'Rabban and Mitzvahs D'Raisa and the interpretation and halacha?
Yeah, but they will use a lot of Tanakh when they're discussing it. Like they will quote something from all over the Tanakh. Whenever the Gemara quotes or whoever, all the other parts of the quote, they will use
Really? Can you name me one place? I mean, I don't expect you to have such a bikias, and I'm not going to tell you it doesn't exist, but name me one place where a posek refers to a pasuk to prove his point. What I'm asking you is, and this is something that some of you, again, this is nothing to do with Tanakh per se, but are we interested, when you study those things, are you interested in studying Tanakh? Or what Chazal had to say about Tanakh, because those are technically speaking two different things. Just by way of example, to jump ahead, when the Rashbam wrote his Perush on Chumash, the Heilige Rashbam, so for the most part, with the exception of a few parshiyos, the Rashbam did not care very much what Chazal had to say when he wrote his Perush. He was a very big Talmud Chacham, and he was also a very firm person. His brother Rabbeinu Tam attacked him for being a firmach. You know, he used to walk with his eyes down, so he went to see women, and Rabbeinu Tam criticized him for it. But nonetheless, when Rashbam wrote his commentary on Chumash, with the exception of a couple of parshios, we'll see this towards the end of the semester when we look at Rashbam as an exegete. So the Rashbam didn't really care what Chazal had to say. So what Chazal had to say about Tanakh, and what someone who does pshat, or what one might theoretically study Tanakh, could be two different things. So if you ask me, do Rishonim, or more specifically Achronim, you know, when they deal with halacha, deal with psukim that are quoted by the Gemara as they're quoted by the Gemara? Yes, but are they studying Tanakh? I think the answer is no. Any others? I mean, it's a very important point what you're saying, but I think that if you look at the reality, you learn in the base medrash, right? How many times, I know the new Ozu Hadar Gemara said the psukim on the sides, and now you really have no excuse if you haven't looked up the pasuk. But when you don't have the Ozu Hadar Gemara, you don't have the psukim on the side, how often do people look up psukim? That's true, but I ask you if you would judge from your experience, either in Eretz Yisrael or here in the short time, in the base medrash, how many people have a chumash or a tanakh by the makom? There are people. I'm not saying that such doesn't happen, but I think that should prove, at least demonstrate, the larger point. Okay. Any other suggestions? I think some of what you said is still maybe true. But yes. Your name?
Josh.
Josh. That is certainly a possible function, but the question is, would one do so, if one were to look, if you were to ask a traditional Jew, where would he look for guidance on moral issues, where would he probably look? I'm sorry? Yeah, he looked to Sifrei Musar, right? He looked to Chazal, Agada. I think you're correct. It theoretically does serve a function. I think that there are certain aspects that Chazal didn't emphasize where one reads Sifrei Nevi'im, particularly Nevi'im Achronim, but Tanakh in general, one gets a certain emphasis that Chazal I wouldn't say disagree with, but certainly don't choose to emphasize, or is not commonly emphasized in, let's say, Agada. So I think you're right that there is, but again, that's somewhat of an untraditional. It's not from, but it's not sort of the traditional way people look at things. Let me turn back to the original answer. What was your name again? Sorry. No, I'll take your question, Steve, in front of you. You are again?
Common.
Okay. I'm going to come back to Common's suggestion, which is certainly a starting point for why we study Tanakh. Steve? Oh, okay. Good. But at least we get another name. The Rashi quotes a Medrash Tanchuma. On the parsha of in Parshas Kisisa, on the word Kichaloso, when God finished speaking with Moshe, so Rashi quotes Makala Mekushetes b'chafdal et hashitim af tamachacham tzarech lios baki b'chafdal et svarim. Just as a kala is adorned with 24 ornaments, which are described in the beginning of Sefer Yeshayahu. Of course, in order to understand the Medrash, you have to know a little bit of Tanakh. Also, it's Perek Gimel Sefer Yeshayahu. So there he talks about what God is going to take away from Benos Tzion. So you see how people went, how women went around. So a Talmud Chacham has to be Baki B'chof Dalet Svarim. I'm not going to talk about it now, but there's an assumption here that there are 24 books in Tanakh. That's something we'll talk about at the end of this section of the course when we talk a little bit about canon. But we generally assume there are 24 books of Tanakh. I will not do what I occasionally do, which is to ask you to write all 24 books and all the triassim and hand them in, because I will be embarrassed and you will be, some of you will be embarrassed. But if you don't know them, you should make sure you know them by next week. Not because I'm going to ask you, but you should make sure you know them by tomorrow, but give yourself a little time. But Talmud Chacham certainly has to be Baki in the names of all 24 Svarim. And so that's one idea. I'm reminded of one of my favorite stories that I like to tell of one of my most distinguished senior colleagues in the yeshiva. I'm not going to say who, but a very, very big Talmud Chacham, a very popular Rebbe, who once commented in a meeting, said that he had a friend. He was commenting about his ignorance of Tanakh. And he said one of his friends referred to him, a cousin of his, referred to him as a Surva Me Rabbanon, but an Ama Oretz Doraisa. And so the Medrash Tanchuma certainly assumes that a person is supposed to be Mekushetes B'chafdal Esfarim. That's on a purely homiletical level. On a more strictly halachic level, the Gemara, I think in Kiddushin, states, V'shkidantam levanecha al tikri v'shkidantam el v'shilashtam. So a person is supposed to take his years and divide them up three ways. So the first third of your life you learn Tanakh. Second third of your life you learn Mishnah. The third you learn Gemara, which of course leads to the obvious question. I'm not going to dwell upon it, but no one knows how long they're going to live, which the Gemara asks and says it means. You take up your time and you divide in three. You have to, even though we never take things for granted, you assume you'll live out the day and you'll spend a third of the day studying Tanakh, a third studying Mishnah, a third studying Gemara. So, of course, those of you learning morning Seder, what portion of the morning Seder do you dedicate to Tanakh? Yeah?
Comment?
I didn't ask what Tosis says. I asked how much time. Morning Seder, do you spend on Tanakh? So you spend it all learning Gemara. Okay. A little Mishnah, right? A few psukim here and there. So, the Rambam of the Shulchan Aruch just passed them straight out. That you study, you divide your time up three ways. The Rambam, I think, already says that once you've learned Tanakh, and it doesn't mean you don't continue to study, but you reduce that portion, and you reduce the portion that you spend on Mishnah as well. However, that's obviously not what people do. It's a problem, but on what basis do they do so? It's a problem regardless of the basis. They do so on the basis of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam in Sanhedrin Daf Chaftal and Amar Aleph, Rabbeinu Tam, on a comment that Rabbi Yochanan made about Bavel, my Bavel, Sheblula b'mikra, Blula b'mishnah, Blula b'gmar. It's all a mixture. That the Talmud Bavli is a mixture of Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. And the Rambam quotes this in Shulchan Aruch. If you read the Gemara very carefully, you will see some very interesting things about Rabbi Yochanan's comment about why it's called the Talmud, why it's called Bavel. It's a very funny kind of agada, because the simple reading of the Gemara is that Rabbi Yochanan was making fun of the Talmud Bavli, as the other Amoraim in that sugya were also doing. But nonetheless, some of the Rishonim may have read it differently, and Rabbeinu Tam uses this as the basis. Unfortunately, Rabbeinu Tam probably knew Tanakh pretty well, but not everybody who relies upon Rabbeinu Tam knows Tanakh. But anyway, that is one of the reasons, I don't know if one of the reasons or one of the justifications for the lack of study of Tanakh. So that's one reason. There is a mitzvah, as Kalman said, of Talmud Torah. There's a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And therefore, Torah Shebichsav is part of that, and it's included in Hashinantam Levanech. There is a second aspect, which is that, and this speaks to certain larger issues, that Tanakh is part, or Scripture is part of our heritage and it's part of our history. Some would say, who cares? Who cares about culture? Who cares about anything of that nature? Chazal have a very interesting comment. The Gemara of Avodah Zarah is an agada talking about Rome. I'm not interested in the agada per se, but about what it says about Chazal's attitude towards certain types of things that nations or cultures are supposed to have. The Gemara quotes a pasuk in Avadia, Bazui Atama Od. It's talking about Edom, and Chazal always associate Edom of the first bias with Rome and the second bias, and they say, Bazui Atama Od. Zo Malchus Romi She'en La Loksav La Lashon. They don't have any kind of writing, a script. They have a writing, a script. They don't have their own culture. It's all imported from somewhere else. Now, if Chazal choose to understand that that's why Edom is called Bazoi, Chazal obviously considered that a Bizayim. And we often have the expression, the Gemara uses it in a different context, but classically it's quoted differently, Shalotei Torah Shlema Shalano Kesicha B'tei L'Shalahem. Yadu should be no different and no lesser than any other culture. So the fact that it is important to have that our culture have a literature, and our culture have what we call really culture, in addition to purely speaking Torah. It happens to be that the Rishonim use this without stating explicitly as much. You ever read the Ramban's Perush al Torah? It's very hard to read if you don't know anything of Tanakh, because the Ramban, he doesn't write in Biblical Hebrew, but he writes many of his sentences using paraphrases. When many of the Rishonim write introductions to their Svarim, their poetry, which was a very popular activity in the medieval period, especially among Chachmei Svarim. So when you see their introductions to their Svarim and all the poetry that they used to introduce, it's based upon Biblical Hebrew. It's based upon Lashon Mikra. So it's important. Tanakh is not just Kiyum of Talmud Torah, but it's part of being a productive nation, as Chazal would have described it, of having a Ksav and a Lashon. How many people here study Tanakh when you're in Eretz Yisrael? Now, I'm not going to ask individual experiences, not too many, but even those who study Tanakh, I would repeat the question: did you study Tanakh, or did you study drashas of Tanakh? I don't understand the question I'm asking. This goes back to the point that I made earlier, some reference to, I think it was Yoel's comment about in order to be able to understand the difference between studying Tanakh and studying Chazal's interpretation of Tanakh. There is a difference between, and again, some of you may have studied Tanakh, there's a difference between studying the text of Tanakh and using Chazal and Rishonim just as one among many tools for interpreting the text, versus studying really Chazal and how they read Tanakh. The purpose in this course, we're not studying a particular sefer, but is to expose you to the study of Pshat. Pshat both in the modern academic sense and Pshat in the sense the way of certain Rishonim took it, particularly Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, and on lesser extent Ramban and Radak, and to a lesser extent Ramban and Rashi. What I mean by that is as follows. It's very hard to define what is Pshat. Pshat is not necessarily a literal translation of a text. That's not Pshat. Let me give the following example. The Torah in Parshas Devarim describes Arim Gdolos Uvtsuros Vashamayim. The Gemara in Chulin, Giranosh, has a comment about that. That's an exaggeration, Lashon Havai, okay? Which is true. But what is Pshat in that Pasuk? Are you going to tell me? What is Pshat in that Pasuk? Arim Gdolos Uvtsuros Vashamayim. What's the Pshat? Does it mean that there's cities? That means the Pshat in that Pasuk is the cities were fortified and tall as far as the heavens, whatever, I don't know what the heavens are either. In terms of our world, I don't know what you call what's the limit, you know, which part of the heavens, which layer of the atmosphere, but is that what it means? Is that the Pshat? I know I'm getting a lot of blank faces. This is not a one-way street, guys. It's two ways. Ariel. It means very large. Is that what the text says?
Not literally.
Not literally. That's a very important caveat. Not literally. Literally, it says Arim Gdolos Uvtsuros Vashamayim, but it clearly doesn't mean that. That's what you tell me. If I were a Jew standing at Har Sinai at Matan Torah, or in the Midbar, as it might be, and I was learning this pasuk, how would I have interpreted it? Would I have interpreted it the way you did, or would I have read it literally? Really? Why would they saw the cities? You didn't, right? You're making an assumption. You're assuming that the cities, maybe they were as high as the heavens. Again, I don't know what that means, but they saw the cities, right? And on the presumption that you're correct, right? So they were smart people. Why would they have read it literally? What would we call that? Call it an idiom. Call it an idiom. Something like that. It's the way people speak. So if you define pshat, you can't define pshat, I think, as literal. That doesn't make any sense. So what? How then would you define pshat?
Ah,
so that's a very good starting point. Okay, the way something is meant to mean. I don't know how many of you have been exposed at all to postmodern thought and the meanings of texts. But why don't we assume that texts, whether they be human or divine, in this case, can certainly, if they're divine, can have multiple meanings. Text can have multiple meanings, right? And I may look at a text and I read one thing, and you look at a text and you read something completely different. Why is it that you and I read things differently? Why would that be? Okay, so David suggests different life experiences. That might be one thing. So it's the baggage, to borrow from Tim O'Brien, the baggage which you carry into reading the text, right? That's one possibility. Yes, your name? You raising your hand or no? Okay, no one was back there. Okay, any other hands up? Okay, yes?
I may focus on a word, or you may focus on something else. Different words in different phrases.
Okay, so sometimes language is ambiguous. And sometimes the same words, this is really, I use this for a different example in grammar, but if I give you the following sentence, the shooting of the hunters was awful. I know that if I asked you to explain that sentence, I don't know if the class would break down evenly, but I would get two different explanations. The shooting of the hunters was awful. It happens to be a little grammatical catch in there, which also exists in Hebrew, but the question is, does that mean that the aim of the hunters was bad? Or was that somebody shot the hunters and it was pretty horrible? The shooting of the hunters was awful. So language in itself can be ambiguous. So that's another reason why people might read a text differently. We're going to see an example later. And again, this for some people may be disturbing because the Rishonim didn't give this interpretation because the Rishonim couldn't have given this interpretation. But when we deal with, it's usually one of my introductory examples to the ancient Near East, and why some of the material that has been unearthed by archaeologists is useful for B'nai Torah studying Tanakh. So I give the following example. The Torah says that Yehuda, Tamar asks Yehuda for a pledge, a security, and she asks for Chosamcha Ufsilecha Umatecha Asher B'yadecha. She asks for his seal, what he signs with. She asks for his stick, and then she asks for his seal. What is a seal? What do you think the word means? It usually means a string. A string. That's what psilim are. Right? You read psilim by the tits, right? Or psilim when they cut up the gold to make gold threads. Vayiraku es pachei hazahav v'kitzeit psilim. Now, that's what the Rishonim start with. And I don't know if Chazal have any comment about it. So the question is, what is give a string? So the Rishonim give different interpretations. Now, what is pshat? Well, pshat is probably the following. The seals that archaeologists have uncovered, I don't know if they're used anywhere in the world today, but they once upon a time were commonplace, what was known as a cylinder seal. You might imagine like a little cork, okay, like a wine cork with an image impressed upon the outside, and you would roll it, okay? Now, how do you think you carried it around? I don't know how common pockets were. Well, they would drill a hole through the middle. And then you would put a string through it, and you'd tie it around your neck. Now you go back to the pasuk, and you tell me, what is pshat in the pasuk? Chosamcha ufsilecha umatecha asher b'yadecha. And I think the obvious pshat is, she was asking for his apparatus and his staff. That's the string she was talking about that goes through the seal. Now, we can argue whether we think this is really the pshat or not. Now, in this case, why is it that I, or those before me, have offered a pshat different than that of those of the Rishonim?
Isn't the knowledge of history...
So this is a different... It's not so different what David was saying, but it means we're bringing different information to the table. You spoke about life experiences. That's one type of thing that goes into effect when you interpret a text. But I'm giving you an example of something that's concrete. Now, it's not that I'm more sophisticated than Rishonim, we just happen to have the archaeology that they didn't have. So, there are many different things that one can bring to the reading of the text. Moshe?
But why would the Torah write that down with the string?
Well, because that's what's... You can ask the question, why did the Torah write the story of Yehuda and Tamar? But the fact is it did, and when it wrote the story, so part of it is that she needed a pledge, that was part of the... And it's an important part of the story, because he sends the Gedi Izim, and they can't find her, right? And therefore, when it describes what? So I can't tell you, can, as a general rule, you can never say why does the Torah record certain details and not others? I mean, especially in the stories. You know, in Sefer Bereishis, Dr. Lamb even mentioned this in this introduction when he spoke about the book, the things they carry. So he pointed out correctly. This is, I think, a davar pashut, that the Torah does not tell the entire life story of the avos. The Torah picks incidents and anecdotes, right? Clearly, one, 40 prakim could not possibly suffice to tell everything in the entire laundry list of what happened to the avos. So I can't explain to you why the Torah chose to reveal these details, but once the Torah did, to understand what it's saying, so I think that this is the obvious pshat. So there are many different reasons why people can read text differently. So then, what is pshat? So someone started out by saying the original intent of the text. Okay. Now, I would agree with you by whoever said, who said that? Okay. So, what's your name again?
Ellie
Tuffer. Okay. So, I would agree that when you deal with a human text, you might be able to speak, I'm not going to be postmodern now, you might be able to speak of one intent. This is what the author meant. Even if he left the language ambiguous, and even if for whatever reason people might read the text later, reasonable people might differ, but certainly with the divine text, so there could be multiple possible meanings. So when we talk about the original intent in studying Tanakh, that's a little bit more difficult to say, well, what was the intent of the author? Well, Kaddish, we assume Shivan Panam Torah, that may not be taken literally, but certainly there may be multiple possibilities. So when we talk about searching for pshat, what do we mean? That's a very, how do you define most simple?
You'll have the possible, you'll have all these different explanations, and somebody's seen more far-fetched.
I agree that you've described what it's not. Pshat is not far-fetched. Okay, it's not drush. Right, it's not where the darshan is using the pasuk to teach some moral lesson, and therefore he gives something that seems far-fetched as the simple interpretation of the pasuk. You've defined what it's not, but saying the simplest interpretation. No, how do you define simple? Yes.
That's how we get different shot, because one person's most simple explanation is another person's most simple.
But I want to know, what are they striving for? I agree. So it's not always easy to tell what is the most simple explanation. You may have different opinions. But what is the Pashtun striving for? What is Radak or Rashbam's agenda? What is his goal when he talks about Pshuto Shemekwa? Yes, your name? Shlomo, yes. They do want to understand what's going on, but when they say they're doing pshat, right? So, what does it mean? What is it that they're trying to understand? What is what's going on? The meaning of the words, the message of the words. Take one more suggestion, then I'm gonna. So that's what drush is. You can also bring out a message from pshat. But when you do pshat, I will tell you that when Pashtunim do pshat through a lot of the Torah, they certainly don't explicitly state any kind of moral message. And very frequently, pshat is very, it's not inspiring. We're going to see at the end of the course, there was a flowering of pshat around Rashi's period for about 100 years or so, a few years before Rashi, and continuing down another couple of generations. And Professor Avram Grossman of Hebrew U has a very long article about this, and his suggestion as to the reason why pshat did not last is because as persecutions resumed in that period in medieval France and Germany, so pshat didn't sit well, wasn't inspiring. Right? Pshat is not inspiring. Eddie? But what about, I go back to the question of Arim Gedolos Sitzuras Dashamayim, a straightforward translation, even if I would be okay, so I agree, but you haven't given me a rule. You're moving and saying literally translate unless. So I'm going to pose the following definition of pshat, and this is one of the things that we try to look at, both to see how the Rishonim do it, and before we get to the Rishonim. Okay, and truth is, I'm leaving out a chunk of the course at the beginning, which is about the authorship of Tanakh, where we're going to study Chazal. But once we get beyond that, what the principal aim is to understand how pshat can be done, both through the Rishonim and through the ancient Near East, and to see how Chazal, the interpretation of Chazal, whether it's pshat or not. But the definition of pshat is, what would the text have meant to the original reader? What would the text have meant to the original reader? If you were a Jew standing there at the time of Matan Torah and you read this text, or at the end of the 40 years in the Midbar, how would you have read it? See, Arim Gedol Sibitzuras Vashamayim, we all would have read the same. The Jew who stood there at that time and he read Chosam Chov Silech, what would he have said? it would have been obvious to him what Tamar was asking for. Why? Because it wouldn't have taken him even 2 seconds to look down at the cylinder seal hanging around his neck or hanging around his father's neck to realize that, of course, that's what she was asking for. Assuming it's correct, again, we can debate it, but it's likely to be the pshat. So pshat means not so much original intent as part of it, but what it would have meant to the reader reading it. Now, we can't always know, obviously, but that's what you're aiming for.
What do you mean by reader reading? At the time of the event happening?
Or? No, at the time of the book being written. Not at the time the event happened, right? I don't know when Sefer Bereishis was written, whether it was written down in any form. I assume it wasn't written before Matan. I assume it was written at Sinai. That's the way Chazal usually understand. It might have been different if it were written. If it were written during the period of the Avos, which Chazal don't assume, so it might have meant something different to the reader then than it meant to the Jews at Matan Torah. But let's assume for the moment it's written at Matan Torah. So what does it mean to the Jews, you know, who received the Torah on the day after Shavuos or the day after Yom Kippur, or whenever, let's say at the end of, in Arvos Moav, at the end of the 40 years, we'll talk about that a little bit, the Gemara in Gittin, when the Torah was, the entire Torah was finally written. So what would they, if they sat in Chavrusa and the Beis Medrash, they didn't have so much Mishnah or Gemara to learn, so theirs was truly Torah Shabbat Peh. So when they read Pesukim, well, how did they read it? Based upon their cultural context and everything they knew, how did they interpret? Presumably, if there is an original intent, that's going to be, assuming they're not multiple intents for the moment. Now I'll play the other side. If there is such a thing as original intent, that would probably be the closest reading to original intent, right? If you have the context and you have the culture, you're more capable of understanding what the original intent is. Okay. Yes?
Effie. I'm just a little confused. If they're reading it at Harsina, is that the point of original intent? Is that when we're assuming the first person to read it was?
That I assume original intent means what did the Ribbono Shel Olam intend? Well, as I said, in other words, I'm not talking about original intent, I'm talking about what would the reader at the time that the text was written or given, how would they have read it? In other words, go ahead.
So the reader wasn't at that, at a lot of these times, the reader wasn't at that event, so he was also a little distant,
I grant you that the Jews who read the stories of the Avos in the Midbar, so they were distant from the event. They were closer to the text, though. Assuming the text was given at the beginning of the 40 years, so they, you know, that was their text.
So can we assume that
is inaccurate? I said it would be the closest to the, that's why I said it's the closest to the original intent. You know, the extreme postmodernists would say that once you write the text, even you can't talk about the original intent. I'm not going into that situation. Yes. Kalman, and then Svei.
The only thing is that, Rashi speaks about like Korach, right? The way that he interprets the Torah, he tries to, you know, do something.
So let me make a very important point here. You have to distinguish between the process of halacha and purely Torah shebichtav on a pshat level. What I mean by that is that when you were learning Sanhedrin, right? So the primary role of the Sanhedrin is what? That is a good, perfect segue. I mean, I'll talk about that. What's the primary role of the Sanhedrin? No, there's not a single case in Shas, where, as far as I know, that where the members of the Sanhedrin Agudal sat. I mean. And judge Dine Mamonos Dine Nefashos. Theoretically, they judge Melech and Kohen Gadol. Yeah, you have an agad about Melechim. But that's not there. Clearly, that's very, very rare. There might be one story that I am aware of that. That's not their role. What's the role, Eddie? Sanhedrin Agadol? No, we don't. Ask Chas V'Shalom. The Rambam would have burned you at the stake. Said once the Torah was given at Sinai, or once Moshe Rabbeinu died, there was no more communication between God and man for the purposes of what the Sanhedrin does, halacha. Okay? Yes? That is a role they play, but that's really secondary. That's an outgrowth of their primary role. Does anybody read the Torah? Anybody do Shnei Mikra V'Chatargim? You know her. You heard the story. Yes, it's interpret Torah Shebichtav. Read last week's parasha. Ki yipalei mimcha davar ala mishpat bein dam ledam bein din ledin bein negel anegel divrei rosh b'sharecha b'kantov alis ala makom ha'shev karash al kecha bo, right? U'vasa ala kone valvi yival shafed ha'shem emhem v'darashta v'higidu l'cha eis divar ha'mishpat v'osis al pi ha'davar sh'higidu l'cha men ha'makom hu ha'shev karashem. Even though I don't know if Chazal ever framed it this way, Korach was a Zakei Mamre, in a sense. The way he's portrayed in the Medrash is a Zakei Mamre. He rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu's authority. The authority to interpret Torah Shebichtav for the purposes of how you behave. Right? What are the examples the Medrash Tanchuma brings that Rashi quotes? Talish Shekulo Tchelis, right? A room of, I don't know, Bayish Shemoli Svarim, this is an Ina Mezuzah, do you need Tzitzis on, right? These are not issues that are explicit one way in the text. This is the interpretation of Torah Shebichtav for the purposes of Halacha. Takanos and Zeros are an outgrowth of that. Right, those are only made the Rabbanon. That's the primary role of Sanhedrin HaGadol, sort of the final decisor of Halacha and the authority of interpreting Torah Shebichtav. But we talk about giving Pshat, so the text has, you know, has its own meaning. Right? So anyway, that is what, even though there's a lot of other material in the course, that's the one part that I hope that you can sort of walk away with. A lot of the other material relates to Chazal and what Chazal said about authorship, about the text of our Tanakh. I'll give you the little slight shot now, but if you look at Rabbi Akiva Eiger on the side of the page in Daf Hamad Beis and Shabbos, okay, when he talks about the difference between the text of the Sifrei Torah and the Sifrei Tanakh that the Amoraim or that the Gemara had and that we have today, that there were, it's very apparent there were a lot of differences. In fact, I'll give you guys the heads up, you're learning Sanhedrin, Daf Dalit or Daf Hei, when you get to the Sugar of Yeshem Lamikra, Yeshem Lamisores, I suggest that you look up the Psukim that the Gemara quotes, because you're going to find some things that might disturb you. They shouldn't disturb you. Again, they only disturb you if you have come to believe certain things about our text of the Torah, that in fact the Rishonim didn't assume, that Chazal didn't assume, that Rukiveigu didn't assume. If you make certain assumptions, you have a problem. But when you get to those Gemaras, you will see. So we'll talk about Chazal's views on authorship, Chazal and the Rishonim's views about the text, but then we're going to really focus more on interpretation of Tanakh, and most of that will focus most of that discussion of interpretation will focus on what is Pshat, both from the perspective of using the ancient Near East and then the Pashtun among the Rishonim. And in between, we're going to talk about Chazal and expose you a little bit to Chazal's kinds of interpretation, different kinds of Midrashim, Targumim, and so on and so forth. The question?
Yeah. According to, you said that it's based on the person who received it at the time of the Torah, aren't you putting a time frame on the Torah? Isn't that
No. When I said I'm putting a time frame, I'm shot.
Right. I'm saying, according to that, it's based on the situation.
Okay. So I understand what you're saying. The answer is, well, let me, I see that I'm jumping ahead to certain other points in the course. When we start the ancient Near East, okay, about week 6, I asked the following question. Why wasn't the Torah given in Hungarian? Well, it's true, he didn't give it in Hungary, thank God. Otherwise, the Torah would be a mitzvah to couch it in red velvet all the time. But no, it's true, it wasn't given in Hungary. Why was it given in Hebrew? I want you to put aside Midrashim or Kabbalistic Midrashim you might have picked up. Andy? Why was it given in Lashon HaKodesh? You know why the Ramban says it's called Lashon HaKodesh? Because the Torah was given in it. That is, by the way, probably correct. That's Pshat, if I can tell Pshat, not in Tanakh. Pshat, why it's called Lashon HaKodesh. The Rambam talks about it doesn't have certain kinds of vulgar words in it or something like that, but the Ramban is probably correct. Like Shekel, the Ramban says, or Shekel HaKodesh. Right? Why is it called the Shekel HaKodesh? The Shekel HaKodesh? No, that was the Shekel that the Mikdash used, that the Kodesh used. It's called Lashon HaKodesh because the Torah was given in it. Why was the Torah given in it then? Yes. Your name again?
Gadi.
Gadi, yeah?
The same thing as why didn't Rebbe Moshe Feinstein write it as Shuos in English.
Okay.
American. Because it's a standard national language. As Jewish people, we all,
You did something very, very interesting there. When you think through what you said, you're half correct, but that is not, I think, related to... It's tautological, if you know what the word means, when you said remote short. The reason why Hebrew is... I would say to you, the Hebrew is a national language because the Torah was given in it. But let's go back to the question of why was the Torah given in it. You're correct, but you're saying it in a funny way. Correct. That's why it was spoken. People often talk about, you know, Lashon HaKodesh is only, it's often an anti-Zionist polemic. That modern Hebrew is not Lashon HaKodesh, only Tanakh. Really? What about Lashon Mishnah? What about Chazal, all our holy Tanaim and Amorim? You know, when they wrote it, it's not clear where they spoke, how much they spoke, but the Lashon, the Hebrew of the Mishnah, which is different than the Hebrew Tanakh, it's not Lashon HaKodesh, Chas V'Shalom. Of course it is. It's just the development. The reason why the Torah was given in biblical Hebrew, that's a tautological term, is because that's what they spoke. I mean, there's poetic language, but of the non-poetry, that's the language that was spoken. What was the Baruch Hashem given in Aramaic, Hungarian, Arabic? That's not what they spoke. Eddie? No. In this case, I think it's too obvious. It's so obvious that they would have been speaking, that the Torah would have been given the language that they spoke. Right, it doesn't make sense through Belshom given language they didn't speak, but probably they would not speak Egyptian.
Well, doesn't it say anyway that
So that is in the med. The Medrash Loshino is Loshona, but I'm not going to bring proof in those historical terms from the Medrash, because when we're going to talk about the function of Medrash as well, the Medrash is delivering a message, not necessarily a historical statement. That's a message to us, not a historical statement about what was. But we'll come talk about that. But that may very well be. In other words, I think you still, nonetheless, with that correction, you may be correct. It's clear from the Torah that the Jews remained a separate entity. The Egyptians didn't want to break bread with them, right? That was early on, but that may have been the case, that there was some type of social separation. Yes?
You said it was the spoken language. Spoken by whom?
The Jews.
But the Jews, at what point in time?
In the Dor HaMidbar. And it continued on, although it developed, and you can see the development in Tanakh, it develops on through the biblical period. When you get to, one of the things you will see when you study Tanakh and you look at the later biblical books, that the language starts to get a little bit closer to that of Mishneh Hebrew, because language does not remain stasis, language develops. Right? The English we speak today is not the English that they spoke 150 years ago. If you were listening to somebody speak today who was brought back, resuscitated in the year 1850, they were in a time warp, would you understand it? Probably yes. Would their dialect be a little bit different? Yes. Would their vocabulary be a little bit different? Yes. Right?
So where did the Hebrew language come from? If that's what they spoke, where did it come from?
Where did language come from in general? I don't know. There were languages, I don't know.
Well, there was clearly not the only language.
What's
fact,
that?
The original language that Aram spoke was from the Aram. He would be speaking Aramaic.
So that's possible. It's possible he spoke Aramaic, but could be when he came to Eretz Yisrael. That could be that Hebrew probably is a Canaanite language. In other words, it's probably a combination of different things. But that's not my interest. But it's clear that they were speaking Hebrew at the time of biblical Hebrew at the time of Matan Torah. Today, if you go to Israel and you speak biblical Hebrew, instead of saying so and so Amarli, you say Vayomerli, they'll look at you funny, right? But that's probably how they spoke in the Dor HaMidbar. Some variant of that, something very close to that. Yeah. Common.
I think we all agree that Hebrew language itself is an unbelievable language. It's incredibly logical. It has there's certain things like there's certain words that are similar that are spelled that mean a couple of things and there are certain words that are spelled very similarly and mean separate things, but you can connect them. So let's say the Jews spoke Egyptian, right? So I guess you're saying that the Torah would be an Egyptian, in which case, let's say all the...
Let me ask you a question, Kam. I don't want to cut your question short, but I do need some discussion on it a little bit. Let me just make the following point. And this is not a criticism, but it should ask certain questions. How many languages have you studied? Are you really particularly good with Hebrew grammar? Are you, even though you speak the English language and perfectly properly and probably write well, are you a bucky in English grammar and the lexicon and so on?
No.
Any other languages that you studied?
Spanish.
So I guess the question I'm asking you is, on what basis can you draw the comparison to say that Hebrew is unique in those respects? That's an important... I'm not... You may be right, you may be wrong. I don't know the answer to that question, but you're making an assumption.
Yeah.
And I will... I'll add one more... piece to that to respond to that, and you can think about it. You can discuss with me at a later point.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of any Gemara that makes such an assertion. Any comment in Chazal that makes such an assertion about the Hebrew language? Very important. Okay, I know that we may pick up certain things, but if you're going to make such a claim, if it's not based upon your own empirical observations, then at least you should cite the Makor and Chazal. When I say Chazal, I mean Gemara's. Midrashim, Rishonim, or something like that, in order to make that point. Because I'm not sure that it's correct. It might be. I can't respond to it because I'm not aware of any such statement by Chazal. And in my experiences with languages, which is a little more extensive, I'm not sure you can make such a judgment.
Well, say Chazal, let's say, makes a lot of things with the Mashiach and stuff like that. Some
people have done it with Shakespeare too.
Huh?
People have done it with Shakespeare too.
Right, so I'm saying that HaKadosh Baruch would have written the Torah then in Egyptian with...
Yeah, I'm sure the Rebbe Shalom, forgive my anthropomorphism, but the Rebbe Shalom was a pretty talented fellow, and if he wanted Gematrius to be there, he could have made them there in any language he wanted. I wouldn't put that past him. So yes, I think that would be the answer. It's Lashon HaKodesh, because that's what they spoke, so if the Rebbe Shalom had to give it in something else, he could have done other things. Moshe?
So can the Lashon HaKodesh change?
Well, that was my. I take it as a davar pashut that of course it does, and that I take it as a davar pashut that Mishnei Kibur is lashon hakodesh.
Did you take the Ramban literally as though it's because the Torah was written in it, or because or what you create, what you make the Torah is what becomes lashon hakodesh?
Well, I'll ask a different question. It's a strange way of framing this. What's nafkamina? Meaning, what difference does it make whether something is lashon hakodesh or not? Because as Chazal say, dvarim shel kodesh are also to say in certain places in the Beis Hakisa and so on, afilu b'lashon chol, and dvarim shel chol is mutal amra afilu b'lashon hakodesh. The only nafkamina is what's nafkamina whether lashon hakodesh continues or not. You're not going to advocate that if lashon hakodesh is only biblical Hebrew, what, that we should now go back, if we want to be really good Jews, we'll go back and speak biblical Hebrew as opposed to modern Hebrew?
No. Why the Ramban is trying to sell?
No, the Ramban is trying to explain where the terminology came from. Right?
Why is there a terminology in the first
place? Lashon HaKodesh? That I can't tell you, but the Ramban's job as a parashan is to explain. He uses that as an analogy to Shekel HaKodesh. You call something Lashon HaKodesh, it means it's the language of the holy object, of the holy thing, or something like that. That's all. The Torah doesn't use the term Lashon HaKodesh. The Torah doesn't talk about,
right.
I mean, it mentions Goy HaShelo Seidah Lishono, but on the whole, it's not a halachic category, Lashon HaKodesh. Right? Sifrei Tanakh, there is one place. As Sifrei Tanakh, whether they can be written Dach in Hebrew or even other languages in Greek and so on, but there, when you write it in Hebrew, you're not going to write it in Mishnah Hebrew. You write it, once you're going to write it in Hebrew, you just leave it as the original Hebrew. If you're going to translate it, well, it's not any Hebrew. It's clearly not Lashon HaKodesh anymore. So when you talk about whether later development is called Lashon HaKodesh once Tanakh closes, once the period of Tanakh is over, I don't know what difference does it make. What does it matter? Right, now, what difference whether it's Hebrew or what difference is whether something is Lashon HaKodesh and Hebrew, and this is just Hebrew but not Lashon HaKodesh? I'm not sure it makes a difference one way or the other. Yes, I'm taking two more questions and then we'll move on. Yes.
Would you call it Aramaic Lashon HaKodesh?
What's that?
Would you call it Aramaic Lashon HaKodesh?
No, the Torah wasn't given in it. You mean because the Gemara? So Lashon HaKodesh is not a halakhic category. It's a colloquial category. It happens to refer to Hebrew. Ramban is just explaining the etymology, the origin of the term. But is Aramaic an important language? If you want to ask me, is it an important language to know? The answer is yes, absolutely. Right? You should be a Bucky in Hebrew grammar. You should be a Bucky in Aramaic grammar. Right? Is it important that you be a Bucky in Hungarian grammar? Probably not, unless you're a linguist. Okay? It's a funny language anyway. But not Indo-European, that's a Semitic stone category. Yes?
So shouldn't whoever writes a new book or whatever just write it in language of most of their readers?
That most?
Of their readers would be reading it?
Yes, that's correct. The only counterbalancing point, and this was the point earlier made by Gandhi, is that, in other words, the Rambam, and my students in Shir know this quite well, the Rambam wrote, unfortunately, most of his stuff, except for, thank God, the Mishnah Torah, he wrote it in Judeo-Arabic, which led to very poor medieval translations and many mistakes based upon the fact that the translators didn't translate properly, many mistakes in interpretation. Now, the fact is that the central, most important work of the Rambam, for many reasons, is the Mishnah Torah, but one of the reasons is because it's the most widely studied, much more so than the Perush HaMishnah, much more so than the Mor Nevuchim, much more so than his Igros. One of the reasons for that, not the only reason, is because the others, everything else, he wrote in Judeo-Arabic. So once the Jews left the Spanish, once they left the Arabic cultures, or once it went to Ashkenazic Europe, nobody could read it, except for the translations. So which works tend to last forever? Well, it's a fairly good bet that in 1,000 years from now, I don't know whether Jews will be speaking English, Hungarian, Yiddish. It's a pretty good bet that whatever other vernacular they have, they will be speaking Hebrew also. Even that speaking it, they'll be writing it and so on. That's, I think, why in Europe, the poskim who wrote Shuvahs, they didn't write them, aside from the fact that they're quoting so much rabbinic literature, which is Hebrew/Aramaic, they didn't want to write them in Hungarian or Polish or anything else, which they did speak, because that would have limited their usefulness in history. And the Rambam provides a very good example of the differences between his works. All right, this will be it. Yes? And one and two. Yeah.
Don't we believe that on an original source is Lashon HaKodesh?
Some people believe that, I suppose. I mean, I'm not going to tell you, I don't know if there's a medrash about that somewhere. What does that mean? I want you to go home. I'm not going to expand further on this. You could have brought me a slightly better riot, but... what does that mean that he named, if a lion, I'm just going to think about, what does it mean he named the lions in Hebrew? If he had named them in English, if he named them in Hungarian, would the lions have been different?
No, I'm saying the actual
I don't know, I think I read this somewhere, the actual essence of the word represents what the what a main characteristic of the animal. So
really?
Is
that true?
I don't know, maybe. I don't see that.
What's that?
There is the start of the Hasidah.
This, that,
within its species.
The but
it's not phonetic.
Right. In other words, someone in Hebrew, they are going to call. Is the Chasidah the name of the stork? How about the stork? Is that? I mean, which represents the animal? Right. We don't happen to call it that way, but it could have been in English. It would have been called the kind bird. Right. Would that be a riot? That would just mean that the people who named it in that particular language named it based upon certain characteristics.
Okay? Where did Adam originally get this language from? Where did he come up with this?
All right, I can't answer that question right now because there are many reasons I can't answer that question but I would just state the following based on the Torah itself, who says he did speak Hebrew, maybe the Torah translates it. Where would Adam Rishon, regardless of which language it was, how would Adam Rishon have gotten his language, right? If you have ever seen, if you have a much younger sibling, or if you've observed a much younger sibling pick up language, it picks up from the people around them. So that's a question nothing to do with Hebrew.
But I'm saying, like, the only being around him was he was the only one to talk to God. So if that makes sense, that, like, you know, he got...
What does it mean? I'm waiting for someone to say that wasn't the world created in Hebrew? And, you know, Asar Mamaros Nifra Olam. And when someone can actually explain to me what that means, I mean, what God spoke, God is when you cite those midrashim, you have to be very careful, because the Rambam would say, certainly about those midrashim, that the nistar is not the nigla, and the nigla has no meaning in that. Okay, so it doesn't... that midrash you're referring to, I'm not sure where it is, but the bottom line is that before you ask questions from the midrash, you have to really understand what the midrash is saying, because just on a literal level, it doesn't make any sense. What does it mean, God's speech? God speaks in one language versus the other? You know, but Moshe Rabbeinu heard a sound in the way we hear sounds, the way I hear you talking. Read the Rambam in the introduction to the first parak of Mishneh Torah in Sefer Amada, and you'll see. Yes.
By the fact that the Torah was only given in Hebrew, if that's the language that was being spoken at the time, so isn't that sort of by implication saying that it's not so much the language that's essential, but rather what's in it, and it was just that they knew the language, so it was simple to give it.
I think that is correct in many ways.
So,
that's why we have a Torah Shebal Peh.
Right, I'm just prefacing my question.
Yes.
Yeah. Nowadays, as you, I'm sure, well know, that if you, like, open an article Gemara as opposed to, you know, a standard edition Gemara, you're sort of, like, looked at, like, oh, who's that bomb? You just know it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Well, why is that then the case if the... If the point is to get the material, and you know what I'm saying?
So I understand the question. You opened up. If I wanted to go on a little bit of a diatribe, I won't. But I just say as follows. I don't think you should look askance at anybody because they open up a translation. The reason why you don't want to use a translation, if it's possible, obviously not if it's not possible, is because translations by definition lose things. When we study Targum, we'll encounter this. The problem that a Metargim faces when he has to translate. You see, I mentioned before, language is sometimes ambiguous, right? So it's very nice if you have an expression in Hebrew that's ambiguous. If you now come to translate it into English or almost any other language, how do you translate it? You're forced to do what?
To pick a side,
to interpret, right? So things always lose in translation.
The Targums are basically explanations.
Well, I'm not going to talk it now, but a Targum by definition is not just a literal translation. It has to involve some interpretation. There are Targumim with much more interpretation and a Targumim which are much more literal. By definition, translation requires interpretation. Okay? All right. On a divine text, it could be they're supposed to mean all. Sometimes one of the options is ridiculous. You often don't even think about it because it's so obvious that it's not that, but it could literally be read that way. Okay. Anyway, I want to just finish the introduction before we start looking at some text with the question, well, why am I doing this? Okay, so Talmud Torah we understand, but you know what? I could read, I'm not going to pick out any sefer because I don't want to discriminate or chas v'shalom belittle any achronisha works on Tanakh, which are primarily drush in many ways. The question is, why should we bother studying pshat? It's a question you could have posed, by the way, to Radak and to Rashi and to Rashbam and Ibn Ezra, but take Rashi and Rashbam, who were not just parshanim on Tanakh, but who were really gedolei harishonim in terms of halacha and gemara in that sense. Why did they bother? Why did the Rashban have to write this newfangled perush, as we'll see in his language, Pshatim HaMishadshim B'chol Yom? Why? Just write the... Why does he continue to write, as some of his contemporaries did, take something like the Chizkuni? You know, when you continue to write a lot of Midrashim, you quote Chazal, you make... There's still Midrashim were being made up. Or Moshe Darshan, if you've seen him quoted in Rashi, was not an Amora. Moshe Darshan was probably 9th, 10th century. Why didn't they continue to do Midrash? Now, so that's a question. The question, so I'm just proposing basically that we try to go back and, or we're looking at going back and doing what Rashi did, and a more better Rashbam is a better example. The question is, why bother doing it? Okay, so yes, it's Talmud Torah, but why should we bother? So for one thing, on the assumption that we like what Rashi, or we believe that Rashbam and Rashi were right in doing what they did, we have a lot of tools that we can bring to it that I would venture to say the Rashbam would have killed for if he could have had. You know, the Rashbam could have had access to... The Rashbam was a phenomenal grammarian, even though he knew no Arabic. But if the Rashbam had been able to know Arabic, and more importantly, recently discovered languages such as Akkadian and Ugaritic, I venture to guess the Rambam certainly, in his Morne Ruchim, states something to the effect, not about languages, but about culture. The Rambam would have killed for that. And I think that the Rashbam and Ibn Ezra and Rashi would have been very grateful if they had had some of the resources we have at our disposal, many of which are only the products of archaeology of the last 150 years. So in terms of one can revisit their work and be engaged in these Pshatim HaMishadshim B'chol Yom, a very intellectually and spiritually, I think, creative endeavor by engaging in Pshat. Secondly, and I think this is important, although not in all circles, it might depend where you live and who the Talmud is, who the student is, but I mentioned earlier, Shalotei Torah Shalanu Kisicha B'Teila Shalahem. Now, Drush on the whole happens to be fairly unrigorous. A good Drush is good Drush and worth hearing, but it's not necessarily intellectually rigorous. Good Drush, you know how a person gives a drasha, and none of you, I don't think you've ever given a drasha yet. There's a great Hasidic story which demonstrates how you give a drasha. And this is what Medrash Chazal is all about, fundamentally. Most Medrash Chazal. It's not about the story, it's about the message. So they went to Hasidic Rebbe, went to some Magid and said, Rebbe, how do you always tell such wonderful stories? So the Rebbe said, let me tell you a story to show you. So what does he do? He says, I once encountered an archer. And the archer, he had just finished shooting, and there he was. He had all his arrows basically right in the middle of the target. And I said to the archer, how do you shoot so wonderfully? So he said, well, let me tell you how. First, I shoot the arrows, and then I draw the target. Okay? And that's what Medrash is all about. Medrash is all about, first, when the rabbi, most rabbis, I hope, when they get up and they give a drasha, assuming they don't wander and meander and take 25 minutes of your time and make you crazy, they have a point they want to get to. And the drasha, the Medrash, they will use whatever makoros, even if they quote unquote misread them or bend them to fit their message. That's what drush is about. Now, there's bad drush and there's good drush. I personally prefer good drush. But it's not necessarily intellectually rigorous. The drush part, the moral message may be very important, but the drush part may not be rigorous. And if one is talking about matching, the intellectual sophistication of other areas of knowledge that we encounter, then when one studies Torah Shebichtav, it should be no less rigorous than anything else. Okay, if you have an alternative of rigorous drush, it certainly would be welcomely added to the mix. That's a second reason. The last reason, I think particularly where we stand is a very important reason, is I would sort of call on the issue of da'a mashatash la bikaras. We are not going to deal with this in this course, if these words mean anything to you, with issues of biblical criticism of the documentary hypothesis. We do touch upon very briefly certain issues that relate to those issues, and for that purpose, and the reason we do that is for the purposes of inoculation. I am reminded of a story an older gentleman told me about a classmate of his in Colombia 40 years ago. They probably were in college 30 to 40 years ago. And this particular student went off the derech. And what drove him off the derech was his probably not Jewish even, probably anti-Semitic professor who took glee in telling the students how there was more than one author to Sefer Yeshayahu. Okay? Now, I suspect that this student had known that this, in fact, was the position of Ibn Ezra and his Rebbe Moshe ben Shekatila, and both of them were Jews in good standing. Now, whether one thinks they're correct or not, he might not have gone off the derech. Or if he had understood something about Amunos Videos, about what is central and what is not, he might not have gone off the derech. But when one sort of has not encountered, and if one, also, if one is aware that such ideas are out there, even though many of them, not necessarily, not automatically Yeshayahu, but ideas, such as the documentary hypothesis are out there, if you're aware of them, when you first confront them, it won't be a shock. If you're not aware of them at all, and then you walk into the outside world, and again, if you go through yeshiva and you graduate, and then you go get a job, and then you go live in some, you know, modern Orthodox or slightly to the, you know, yeshiva suburb, and never read another book, so you probably won't encounter. But if you at any point in your readings or intellectual endeavors encounter this, it should come as a shock to you. You should be aware that it's there. You should be aware that maminim b'nei maminim have given serious thought to these issues. And they still go to sleep at night, they still wake up in the morning, they still put on talis and tefillin, they still make their brachos and do a whole host of other things that observant Jews do. So that even if you don't have the answer to every question, realize that these questions have been considered by very serious Talmidei Chachamim, very serious Orthodox thinkers and Jews before, and the world doesn't come to an end. And therefore it's sort of important, at least to be exposed on the fringes, is what I would term an inoculation to these matters. So when you encounter the ancient Near East and someone tells you, oh, this is what it says in ancient Near East, it shouldn't be news to you, and you also often know where some of the distortions are. David.
What is the documentary hypothesis?
The documentary hypothesis is the reigning theory in academic Bible circles outside of YU and Bar Ilan. As the Torah is composed of multiple documents, which means multiple authors. Those of you who studied with Royer's approach in his what's it called? Something Mikra. What's it called? But we'll know that he sort of responded to this in a certain type of fashion. So that's the only place I think too many of you might have been exposed even to the idea that such a notion exists. But it exists. Obviously, we cannot brook any such hypothesis. It fundamentally conflicts with our most basic principles of faith. Now, what we will be doing during the course of our course, in a number of occasions, is to be resorting to certain types of tools that are very popular in the academic Bible world. But my job, and your job to a lesser extent, is to serve as the filter, those things that are useful to us and those things that we consider unacceptable, things that we simply can't accept. When we study Tanakh, when we study, call it Bible, it's different than when it's studied in all other universities because, officially speaking, we have what I would call sacred cows. There are some conclusions that we simply cannot come to, at least if we wish to remain, I don't mean physically here, but spiritually here. There are certain conclusions, such as the documentary hypothesis, we cannot accept because it would conflict with other issues. Now, theoretically, a university or an academy, and this should be true most courses that you take, is supposed to be about full freedom of intellectual inquiry, full freedom of the intellect. We have certain limitations when we study Tanakh. We have certain, as I said, sacred cows. In the academy, when they study Bible, they will say, even if it's probably not true, that they have no sacred cows, and they can come to any conclusion they want, and therefore it is a more intellectually honest endeavor. They have their sacred cows also. The documentary hypothesis is one of them, and anything that would suggest otherwise, they have a hard time swallowing. But nonetheless, they officially would deny that and can deny it. We would never, Chas v'Shalom, officially deny that because we do acknowledge we have sacred cows. There are other issues as well that when we sort of encounter academic Bible that we have to be careful about, in that there are some assumptions that we cannot accept that they make, which are not based upon intellectual inquiry, but are based upon, I would say, axiomatic issues. If we encounter a story in Tanakh that predicts the future, a Navi predicts the future, so our assumption is, well, the Navi wrote it, he predicted the future because he was given Nevuah. If I were a secular Bible professor and I read that same passage, what is my automatic conclusion? It must have been written after the events because he doesn't subscribe to the notion of prophecy. Now, this is what I would call the belief in prophecy is non-rational. Not irrational, it's non-rational. Irrational is when I say to you, there's nothing on this desk. That statement is irrational. Okay? The belief in God, or the belief in Torah and Shemayim, or the belief in prophecy is non-rational. It's not subject, despite some of the medieval's attempts, it's not subject to proof or disproof. It's not subject to scientific principles. Despite all the philosophers and Professor Johnson, if any of you are taking him, I don't believe that God's existence is subject to rational proof and can be proven, or for that matter, disproven. And the same thing, to the most part, is true about Torah and Shemayim. It certainly is true about prophecy. Prophecy is not rational. It's not irrational, it's non-rational. You can't prove it, you can't disprove it. So when you read a book in Tanakh, a Mamin ben Maminim reads it with a different set of axioms which can't even be proven. You know, a documentary hypothesis, theoretically you can try to bring proofs one way or the other. You can attempt. It's sort of, we just don't have enough information. You know, we don't have a copy of Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah. They would say it doesn't exist, but we had it, so then we could prove something. It's not something that will ever be provable, but theoretically, intellectually speaking, it's provable. But the belief in prophecy, and there are other things like that, are simply, by definition, not given to proof one way or the other. And so those of us here, when we study Tanakh, for whatever tools that we can import from the other world, there are certain tools we can't import because there are certain assumptions that we just share. We just don't share. However, in conclusion, and I'll take your comment, Donnie, in conclusion, where the tools are useful and where they've been properly filtered, they should be accepted. If you want a very good example in history where this was done, it wasn't as much threatening, although there was another religion. The emphasis that one finds in the Rishonim, tremendous emphasis on grammar, is a product of the influence of Arabic and of Jews and Muslim culture. That was the direct byproduct. Rav Sadia Gaon's great interest, and others who followed him, Ibn Ezra, that's a direct product of the systematizing of grammar of Arabic, and then Shalotei Torah Shalema Shalanu Kesicha B'Teila Shalahem. So it was done with Hebrew as well. Okay, and you, some of you may know that grammar in its early stages was a little bit primitive in Hebrew, right? Until you got to Ibn Jarrah and you got the three-letter roots, which is accepted by all the Rishonim who follow. So you had people debating two-letter roots and so on and so forth. So there were external influences, and the Rishonim, the Gaonim, took advantage of these tools, and they used them to further the study of Tanakh, and we should welcome the same things. I might add one point in conclusion. It's a sore spot some of my students elsewhere know, is the issue of grammar. One of the things we will not spend any time in this course, but I highly recommend that if you can take Biblical Hebrew in the course of your college career here, that you should do it, because most people don't know very much of Hebrew grammar. And if you think it's not important, aside from the fact that you can't really read Tanakh properly without it, those of you who do Shnayim Mikraviecha Targum, you basically, if you're going to do it the way it's classically done, which is either you do Unklus or you do Rashi, you're faced with one of two choices. You either learn Aramaic properly, which you should do, or you learn Biblical Hebrew properly, grammar, because the only way to understand half the Rashis in Chumash is by understanding grammar. I know that when most of you were in elementary school and or high school and they did Rashis, what happened when you got to those Rashis? Skip them. You skipped them for two reasons. They A, not interesting, and B, in many cases, unfortunately, the teachers didn't know it either. Rashi obviously took grammar seriously, otherwise he wouldn't. Ink and parchment were very expensive. Rashi would not have wasted his time, and neither would other of the Gedolei HaRishonim, speaking and writing about grammar if they didn't think it was important. If they thought it was important, presumably we should think it's important too. Gadi, you have a comment?
Yeah, so you said that prophecy is not rational. So who am I to think that Jesus wasn't right, Muhammad wasn't right? I mean, the classic difference between, when someone asks what's the difference between Judaism and the rest of religions is,
I'm going to cut this one short. You'll argue this with me another time, but if you give me a Sikha Hashem at the time with you, I'll demonstrate to you that line of argumentation is ridiculous. It sounds good on the surface, but it's not true. It just doesn't. If you understand what biblical criticism is about and what the whole historical critical school is and what their tainas are, then you will realize that argument doesn't hold water. I will only tell you, I'll just say this, bekitzer, which is, if you accept the premise that the Jews were in the Midbar, et matan Torah, you accept that, if that's your ground rule, and the only question is, did the Ribbono Shel'olam really speak to them or not, then that's a great line of argument. But, if you're going to deny that historically even such a thing really happened, okay, and you're going to suggest a completely different hypothesis to how the Sefer Torah we have came to develop, then that argument goes out the window. It's nice when you're on a polemic on the street corner, you know, with the Christian preacher who subscribes to God also and subscribes to prophecy, and now you really only have, and he even subscribes to the Bible as the literal truth, you know, that historically happened. So now you're having a machlokas, you have a great response to him. It's good for that. But when you're responding to that, it's wonderful. Or to perhaps a Muslim polemic. I don't know if we have any of those on the street corners. But when you're trying to respond to a completely different set of arguments, the argument falls apart. And the reason why we believe in Tarmina Shemayim is because my father told me and his father told him, and we're Mamina Bnei Aminim. That's the bottom line. It comes down to Amunah. It's not something that one can prove. That's correct. What's that?
I mean, I've always been taught that they're wrong.
We believe, of course, we belong because that is our Masorah. I'm not arguing that they're
just as much of an argument as they do.
From a detached observer's perspective, that would be correct. But you know what? And who gets to judge that ultimately? The Rebbeinu Shel Olam. It's not our problem to judge them, right? So anyway, I understand that. I was taught that also. I know I went to school, elementary school, much longer ago than you did, and I went to probably the largest elementary, what is now the largest elementary school in this country, and quite a very firm place now. I was taught that Judaism allows you to ask all sorts of questions. My sense of the tenor of Orthodox Judaism in the last 10, 15 years, and probably your experience in Eretz Yisrael, I don't think they encourage asking so many questions anymore. The world has changed. So anyway, but that's what I was taught then, but I don't think it's true. Okay. Anyway, enough for the introduction. I want to now start with the first source. If you open your reader, okay, I would sort of ask this question. Anybody here learned Bava Basra before? The entire, the first parak, the whole first parak? Anybody learned the first parak? I know everybody learns Cheska Sabakim. What is that? What you learned? Yeah, okay, that's the popular, that's the Lundish parak, right? The first parak has too much agada. Too much agada for some people. I don't think there's anything wrong with that personally, but if I were to ask you, how do you know that Chazal believed that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Torah? What would you say? The Torah doesn't exactly. The Torah says that Moshe wrote something. It doesn't say at the end, right? I mean, that's one of the classic problems, right? The Torah certainly doesn't say that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the story of his own death. That's for sure. Whether he did or didn't, separate question. It's a machlokas hatanoi, right? But where does the Torah say? Okay, where does the Torah say? In earlier Dvarim, you have Zosat Torah Shasam Moshe Lefnei Bnei Yisrael, but that may not be the safer Torah. That may be Talmud, you know, the contents, right? Yes. Your name?
Eliezer.
That's Hashira Zos. That's the Shira. That's Hazina. What's Hashira Zos? I understand Chazal's interpretation. So Machlokes have shown what that means. I think it's the Rambam who has a very strange read of that pasuk. He says it only means Hazinu, but since you're not allowed to write only one Megillah, one part of the Torah, you have to write the entire Torah. That's like the mitzvah of a Ksiva Sefer Torah, right? But he took that pasuk to refer to only the Shira. Okay, we're arguing on certainly on a pshat level. Okay, and that's it. Okay, yeah, Gadi. That's the Aseret HaDibros. Aseret HaDibros, that's not
the whole.
Chazal do not assume that the entire Torah was as we have it. Everybody in Chazal agrees in the Gemara and Gittin. No one says that the Torah as, if we read the Gemara, Peshuto certainly, that the Torah as we have it, you know, Chamisha Sfarim Hasumin were given at Har Sinai. The only question is, was Torah Megillah in or Hasumin enough? It's Hasumin and it was given, it was Hasuma, the text of the Torah, at the end of the 40 years. Because you couldn't have, you know, I asked this question. If the Jews had gotten the Torah at Har Sinai, as we have it, so don't you think they maybe would have been careful with the Meraglim? Because they would have read what was going to happen. I want you to think about that question. That's one of those questions that always bother me. But obviously not. Right? If you ever learn Sefer Malachim, when the Navi gets up and predicts to Yeravam that he may vain no lad leves David Yoshio Shemo, if the later people had the Sefer Malachim as we have it, you know, if the people at the end of the Vayesheni, when Amon Harasha had his child born and named him Yoshia, was he reading the first Sefer Malachim? I'm not answering that question. I'm just throwing it out. It's the same type of question. Okay.
It's the same type of thing now. We have to talk about how we know what's going to happen if we go off of there. But we still do it.
There's a difference. You listen, if your mother tells you to be careful of traveling in the New York City subways, so what do you say? Yes, Mom, okay, and then, you know, as you get through your college career, you're a little careful, whatever. If I tell you don't travel on the subway on September 3rd at 3 o'clock because there's going to be a bomb that's going to explode in the 184th Street station, will you stay away? Okay, so there's a
the
Tochacha is a general rule, right? If I tell you that if you don't prepare for class, you're not going to do well. Are you going to every week walk in fastidiously? No. If I tell you I'm giving you a quiz next week and I'm going to ask three questions and if you get less than a 50 on it, I'm going to fail you for the course, will you be prepared? I'm just kidding. I'm not saying that. Right? The answer is there's a very difference between a specific statement, and that's not even so specific. You know, what if I said, God, you, only you, okay, and you're the only one to take the quiz while everybody's watching. You think you'll prepare? Okay, so the point is that you can't bring a raya from a very generic warning. If you think Moshe Shmuley, you know, Vayayim Shemoa Tishma, right? The Kol Hashem Elokecha. It's not the same thing as a very specific prediction of events being described. As a general rule, one will find it's very rare that very specific events are described through Nevuah. Okay, it's very, very rare. As Ramban will see at some point, hopefully, during the semester. Okay, so I want to know, so you don't have a great pasuk. You have the one pasuk in, I think, the Vayelech, and so on, that would at least theoretically encompass most of the Torah, presumably, right? And then he gives it to the Levim. Okay? So how do you know? Yes. No. It's in that context. I think it's clear. You could very well argue that Pshuto Shemikras is giving the entire Torah, maybe minus the end. I mean, I think. Okay. Now. Vayelach. Okay. But I'm just throwing out possibilities. How do you know that Chazal hold that the Torah was given by, was written by Moshe Rabbeinu? So if you learn Sanhedrin, you learn Mishnayos, you will know about one line, which, interestingly enough, is not discussed in this Gemara Basra, is that the Elu She'en Lahem Chelak Lolam Haba, HaOmer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. Now, we're going to have to explore what that means, because it doesn't mean what you think it means. The Rambam certainly didn't read it that way, and I suspect Chazal didn't either. We will look at the Rambam's Eighth Ikar very, very carefully, because the Rambam's Eighth Ikar was misinterpreted by many who followed. If you just, again, don't rely upon me, we're going to read the Rambam carefully. The Abarbanel arguing on the Radak probably read it, I don't say correctly, but he read it the way I'm going to read it. And the Abarbanel jumped all over the Radak for saying, the Radak wasn't reading, we're going to see this Radak, he wasn't reading the Eighth Ikar of the Rambam, but he was talking about something, and the Abarbanel jumped all over the Radak based upon his reading of the Eighth Ikar, but the Rambam never said it. And we'll see that inside. And it also became very popular, probably because of the animamis in the Siddur, which the Rambam didn't write. I don't know who wrote, but that should not be taken as expressing the view of the Rambam, but rather somebody's view who summarized the Rambam lefi das atzmo, not necessarily according to what the Rambam said. Okay. Anyway, so that's one point. But how do you know that Moshe Rabbeinu, wrote the Torah as we have it? So look at the source, the Gemara Baba Basra, which talks about the origin of the different books of Tanakh. Okay. And if you read this Gemara very carefully and very straightforwardly, you may discover that some things that you realize. Okay? Can I have a volunteer? Go ahead. Ellie. Okay. Start Tanu Rabbanan, yes. In the Daf Yud Dalet Amud Beis and Baba Basra. Tanu Rabbanan. Dan
Shalim, Yeshua, Yeshotim, Shmuel, Umalachim, Yumia, Vehetko, Yeshaya,
Ushnemasar. Okay, now, what's missing here? If you were starting to read this Brisa, there's one obvious thing that's missing. Yeah. Well, no, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't write Nevi'im. Chumash, what happened Sidron Shel Torah? The answer is, there is no Sidron Shel Torah because it was Sidra Davar Pasha. Okay, the Torah is not rearranged. Now, what's not, is there not Kamina, by the way? For Bibles? Why? Who cares what the order is? So today... somebody already realizes in his Tanakh. We don't even follow this order, but I'm asking, what did it mean to have an order in the first place?
Are you chronological?
No, because it's not following chronological speed, not at all. The only halachic relevant nafkamina is if you're going to write a sefer of Nevi'im and not write them as individual books. Most of you in your shuls, you either read from a book or a Tanakh or something like that, but there are anybody daven in a shul where they read from the Svarim? Okay. I grew up in a shul where at some point, it caused a lot of machlokas, where they started reading from a clock, but that wasn't even Sifrei Nevi'im. That was just an ashtarta, which is really a bidi'evet, but maybe better printed book. It was just the individual haftorahs written on to one continuous scroll. Okay, but in terms of, the Beis Medrash has Sifrei Nevi'im for the haftorahs, that's what they read from on Shabbos and on Tainis. But each sefer is its own, right? Yeshaya is its own, Yirmiyahu is its own, so it doesn't matter the seder. But if you were going to write Nevi'im in one big scroll, that's what it would matter for. As somebody already picked up on, what's your name again? Josh. Our Sifrei Tanakh do not follow this order. Okay, most of our Sfarim, okay? We eventually talk about it. We're not there yet. But let's get through the Gemara at least, okay? So it says, Yeshua Shotim Shmuel Lachim, that's chronological, that's the way we have it. Yirmiyahu, Yechezka, Yeshaya, Shneimasar. So the Gemara says, go ahead. Whoever's reading. Hoshea is the earliest of the Nevi'im Achronim. Chesiv. Tchilas Diber Hashem Boshea. And if you know a little grammar, you realize that the grammatical construction makes no sense. That's why Chazal were bothered by it. It's just like what? Anyway, you should know this pasuk if you've ever learned Hoshea. From the first Rashi and Chumash, it's the same grammatical problem of Bereshis Bara Elokim.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to embarrass anybody to ask you to translate what Bereshis Bara Elokim means. Because you're going to translate for me as if it said Barishona Bara Elokim, but it doesn't say that. It says Bereshis Bara Elokim. And that means something else. And the Rishonim spilled a lot of ink on this. That's why grammar is important. Anyway, the same grammatical problem here, Tchilas, they quote this pasuk there. Tchilas Dibar Hashem Boshea, Dachim Hashem Dibar Tchila, Nav, Alomi Moshe, Varoshea, Kamen Nevi'im Hayim. So what's the answer? What is the what was quoted here? The okay, so he was the earliest of four Nevi'im who prophesied at that time. And who are they? Amos and Micha. Now, how do you know that these four Nevi'im were at the same time? So he has to learn. You have to learn some of them. What's that?
They speak about each other.
No. 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 The only time I know of a Navi who quotes another Navi is Yirmiyahu who quotes Micha Hamarashti. It's Micha. I don't think they quote each other. Although Yeshaya and Micha, one of them must have read the, probably Micha read Yeshaya, and there are at least a couple of psukim where the same language is used. But aside from that, how do you know that these four people came together? Because when you look at the beginning of all the Sifrei Nevi'im, basically, not all Treyasar, but all the big ones and a bunch in Treyasar, Hoshea and Amos among them, you get the year, the kings under whose reign they prophesied. And you will see that Yeshayahu and Amos and Micha Hoshea all basically have the same overlapping set of kings. Okay, that's why Yeshayahu, that you've heard, you know, Divrei Yeshayahu Benos Asher Chazal Yeshayahu Dinei Uziyahu Yosama Chazi Chizkiyahu Malchei Yehuda. So you can match the kings up. That, by the way, is the same exact same set of kings of Yehuda as in Hoshea. Micha, I think, is a little, he's only like the last of those kings. I don't remember how Amos is. Anyway, so that you get it from the beginning of those Sfarim. Okay, of course, you have to learn those Sfarim to know that. So why doesn't Hoshea go first? For the Kadmei Hoshea Bereisha. So the answer is. Malachi v'chagai Yischai. V'chagai Yischai Malachi sof Nevi'im havu. Since Hoshea's prophecy was written along with Chagai Yischai Malachi in the same sefer, and Chagai Yischai Malachi were the last Nevi'im, so therefore, chashivlei. Adai. Sort of, it puts them together. Okay, so. V'lichtevei l'chudei v'likadmei. So tell you what, write Hoshea as a separate sefer. Right? It's 14 prakim. Right? 14 short prakim, but 14 prakim. Mirkas. What does that mean? What is Aid? It's because it's small, what will happen? What is Mirkas? It's going to get lost. It's going to get lost, right? Right? You don't lose a whole book normally. You lose a paper, right? So Hoshea, small, you don't want to lose it. Okay? So Michtei. Michtei Yeshaya, Kadim Yermi. Chronologically, Yeshaya comes first, so. Yeshaya should be placed first. So now the Gemara says. So the end of Malachim is about the Churban. It's downbeat. And Sefer Yirmiyahu is mostly, the Gemara says Kulei, but it's mostly, there are Nevuos of Necham and Yirmiyahu, as someone has pointed out. If you learn the Svarim, but you don't remember exactly, and someone quotes you Yirmiyahu, certain prakim sound like they could have been written by Yeshayahu, because they're Necham. So Yirmiyahu is mostly Churban. V'Yechezkel. So the beginning of Sefer Yecheskel is primarily downbeat, but the end is more the futuristic based on Mikdash and so on. And then, and again, Yeshaya is not Kulei Nechemta. Remember, all extreme statements are not going to be completely true. Right? I mean, that's not the point. It means it's mostly Nechama. So therefore, together you want a thematic connection. Is there any question now? Okay. Go ahead. Now, and by the way, what do our Tanakhs have for the order? Yeshaya Yirmiyahu Yecheskel Treyasar. Leaving out the Treyasar issue, follows the chronology. Well, 1 second. What's that? We'll talk about it. When I'm finished with the Sidran Shel Ksuvim, maybe today I'll discuss this in a minute. Go ahead. Sidran Shel Ksuvim. That's the order, okay? So first you have Rus, then you have Tehillim. Okay, so let's see. So why, and then comes Iyov. So the Gemara says.
The Manda Amar, Iyov, the Mimosha Haya, the Kadmei the Iyov,
If you're going to, chronology is the natural order. So if Eov, in fact, lived during the times of Moshe, and some of you may know the famous Medrash that the Gemara quotes a lot later, that Paro's three advisors, okay? So if you believe that Eov, and Eov, by the way, there are a number of opinions Chazal when Eov lived, including one opinion that Eov never lived. He was a mashal. Talk about early Drush. So why, if according to that Mandamar, why does the Brisa, this is not the Brisa talk anymore, but this, by the way, realize this Brisa is broken up into pieces. Again, not something that you may have been taught to pay attention to, but the Brisa is broken up. So according to the Mandamar, Eo was in the days of Moshe, why doesn't Eo come first? So the Gemara says, suggests, At Hule Bepuranusa Lomas Chalina. You don't want to start on the downbeat, right? It's like if I walked into the course and said, okay guys, 80% of you are going to fail. Okay, so you know, I'll wait till after this, no, I'm kidding, after the sixth lecture, then I'll tell you that. Right? So you don't want to start on Purim. That was a joke. For those who perked up just to that, I'm just kidding. By the time those of you who are going to drop, you know, it's rare that grades go below a B. Now, I can't say if that's because I'm an easy grader or because all of the people who are afraid are weak or drop before you get to that point, but that's been my general tendency in the past. What's that? Darwinism, yes. Okay. Selection of the fittest. So they answer the next question. Rus Nami Puranusi. So Rus is also Puranus. So therefore, why should Rus come first? So the Gemara says. No, I mean, it was a down start, but you know, the theme of Rus is basically positive. Eov has a happy ending, and if you assume Eov was a mushel, that it's even harder to understand that happy ending, but Eov is a depressing book. Basically, where is God? Okay? So therefore it's appropriate that Rus can come first, even if it begins with, you know, Vayhi Veshafot HaShoftim, and Vayomas Elimelech Ishnami, and Vayomusu Gam Shehem Achon V'Chiyom, still it's okay. So then, the Gemara said, why is she called Rus? Now this is a hard word. Everybody who reads this first usually misreads this. Sherivahu. Now it looks like Sharyuhu, which is a completely different word. Sherivahu la Kodesh Baruch Hu b'shivas hashpacha. He overwhelmed, or I don't know a good English word for it. Merava means to provide plenty, or be given plenty, or something like that. So that's why it's called Rus. Now, why do our Svarim? Does this follow our Svarim?
No.
Not even close. There are different orders in our Svarim. The general rule in our Svarim, not always, I think Reb Breuer's earlier Tanakh, and I'm going to talk about his Tanakh at some point before the end of the first half of the course, but in the earlier version that was printed by the Moseder Rav Kook, the single volume Tanakh, so I think he had Divrei Hayamim early on, the first thing in Ksuv, okay, if I'm not mistaken. But standard orderings in Tanakh tend to be the Sifrei MS first, Eov Mishlei Tehillim, and then the Chamish Megillos, and then, not necessarily, by the way, not in that order necessarily, MS, but it, you know, it's more typically, in Reb Breuer's current Tanakh, it's Tehillim, I don't remember if Eov or Mishlei comes first after that. Tehillim, Mishlei, Eov, okay. And then the Chamish Megillos don't always come in the same order either. I think Reb Breuer's thing, I don't know, it occurred to me last year for the first time why actually they ordered that way. The order, I think, is Shirashirim, Rus, Echa, Koheles, and Esther, and the reason for that is as follows, the Chagim as we read it, okay, but that of course assumes that they were already reading whenever this order was composed, and I'll talk about that in a moment, that assumes that that's what they were reading. They were already reading those Megillus and those Yom Tovim, which is correct. Certainly, maybe the Gemara doesn't talk about reading anything besides Esther, but already Masechah Sofrim, I think, has some of the other Megillus. Masechah Sofrim is probably 6th, 7th century. And then at the end you have Daniel Ezra Nechem Edivre Hayom, okay. Now, where does our order come from? Was it from Gutenberg? Even though the Tiferes Yisrael speaks highly of him, he certainly was not he was the inventor of the printing press, and he published the first Bible. So was it he's the one who had the authority to give the order to Tanakh? I mean, he was as the Tiferes Yisrael speaks very highly of him in his commentary on Mishnah Avos, or praises him for having invented the printed press, but he's still not a halachic authority to decide the order. So where does the order come from? I guess I'm allowed to shock you one more thing. Where do our nekudos in the text come from? What's that? No.
Yes.
Nekudos.
Yes.
What did you say again? Say it one more time. Who'd you say?
Me?
Yeah.
I mean,
what'd you say?
What I heard was that when the Goyim ran through it.
Goyim? The nekuda dots, the bell? No.
Not the bell. Oh, no, I'm thinking of the
Sukkot breaking.
What's that? Oh, yes, the chapter breakups, yes, that's the King James Bible. And they didn't do a very good job at that, as it is. But they just broke it in ridiculous places. You get partios, and then, you know, one part. But no, where do the nekudas come from? What's that? No, I didn't ask you how to pronounce them. I want to know where the dots come from. By the way, it's true about... I'm not going to say where the pronunciation came from, but there isn't always the same pronunciation, the whole Kvutas Yisrael. So where does that come from? There is, by the way, at least three systems of vocalization of the dots. If you look in Nikud Bavli, which the Taimanim still, I don't know if they use anymore, many of the manuscripts have, for example, Segel and Patach are not differentiated. They're both a straight line that looks like a Patach above the line. Okay, they're not even all in the same place. Nikud Bavli is above the line. Most of our Nikudos, which is the Tiberian Nikud, is below the line. And not all of ours, but most of ours. The same thing too is, where does the Truf come from? It comes from the Tiberian, I'll talk about our Svarim, but it all emerges from the same period. It emerges from the Tiberian Masoretes between the 6th and 10th century of the Common Era. Okay, Chazal talk about having some type of trup, but their trup was not fixed like ours is. Because Chazal talk about certain psukkim's interpretation being ambiguous. If they had trup, it would be no ambiguity where to put the comma. Anyway, but our system, certainly our signs, which have changed, by the way, since the Bali Masorah have done it, if you're just for a point of curiosity to see how things have changed, the reason why Tlisha Gedola is always written before the word and Tlisha Ketana is always written after the word is because the original sign that was used was just one circle, and the only way to distinguish it was where you put it on the word. Okay, but putting that aside, so who gave us our Sefer Tanakh? Who gave us our Nekudos? They were the Bali Masorah of Tveria. The Rambam talks about this, not about the whole process, but he refers to the Sefer Torah of Rav Aaron ben Osher, which is probably the Aleppo Codex. It's the basis, theoretically, for Rav Breuer's Tanakh. And the Bali Masorah were the ones who gave us sort of our first vocalized and not printed text. They used to write them, and we call a codex. Anyone know what a codex is? It was written on parchment, but it was bound like a book. Okay. One time, if you go to the library, I'll insist you go to the library, you should look at the facsimile, which is just a photographic book. Of the, if any of you ever somehow managed to find your way to my house, I have a copy of the Leningrad Codex. You'll see it's written in three columns. There are nekudos, there's truck, there are Masoretic notes on the side. I know you ignore those in some of your chumashim, but there are these little Masoretic notes. Those are important. So anyway, the Bali Masorah are the ones who gave us our Sifrei Tanakh. They are the ones who gave us our order. Not all Svarim in the early medieval period may have followed that order. But now the question is, why did the Bali Masorah not follow the Gemara? Okay? And to this, I can suggest one of three possibilities. Possibility one, possibility one is that the Gemara is not really a halachic Gemara. It's really, and it's not, it has some relevance, halacha lemaisa, but it could be viewed sort of as an agada, sidron shel nevi'im. So it could be that it's not hard, stead, and fast, and therefore, if you want to write, certainly if you write svarim in a different order, it doesn't passel them. It doesn't passel them at all, okay? So it could be, again, these are the Bali Masorah. Where do they live again? I said in Tveria. Very, very important. Because those of you, if you take medieval Jewish history, you'll have to figure out, when did the Talmud Bavli become the authority of all the Klal Yisrael? Well, let's just say that when it came off the hypothetical printing presses, not printing presses, but when it was finished in Bavel, whenever exactly that was, it was not accepted in Eretz Yisrael at the time. There continued to be long battles between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, including among the Gaonim, for who would dominate, you know, whose authority would dominate. Eventually, the Talmud Bavli became binding. Now, this leads us to the second possibility, which is that it could be that the Bali Masorah, being a part of Eretz Yisrael in Tveria, they at the time, certainly when they started giving order, it could be that they did not regard the Bavli's system of ordering. It's a brisa, but it's only found in the Bavli. They may not have regarded that as authoritative, and that may have been why they felt free to ignore it and to follow a more chronological ordering. Okay, there might be other possibilities, but those are the two most obvious ones that come to mind. Why did they order it the way they did? So there's one obvious explanation, which is chronology. There is one other possibility that should not be discounted. It's the ordering principle which determines, for the most part, how our Masechtas is ordered. Rosh Shiragon, in his famous Igeris, which you should know about but not in this course, Rosh Shiragon writes that there's really no Seder within a Seder. It doesn't matter what order you put the Masechtas in. Rebbe didn't learn them in any order, but nonetheless, we have a pretty definite order for most, except for in the middle of Moed, maybe, and a little bit at the end of Kutchum, we have a very definite order. It's generally based upon size. If you actually look carefully, Our svarim, except for Treyasar, do sort of follow. I shouldn't say that. Actually, no. It goes the other way. This is not for the Bali Nisar. This is for why Chazal ordered the svarim the way they did. Ironically, they ordered it. Yirmiyah, Yechezkel, Yishayo, and Treyasar. Now, even though if you know count the prakim are 52, 48, 66, and 67, count psukim. Yishayahu and Treyasar, especially, but even Yishayahu, have much shorter prakim. That's just the King James people. If you count the number of psukim in each sefer, so the order would be, in fact, the way the Braisa has it. As a possible another reason why the order might have been that way. But the Bali Masorah, going back to my original point, the Bali Masorah ordered it the way they did either because they thought that the Gemara was perhaps agadic in nature, or because they didn't subscribe to the authority of the Gemara of the Bavli in Eretz Yisrael at the time, at least where the order was. No, by the time of Aaron ben Asher, the last of the great famous Bavli Masorah at the end of the 10th century, so that probably the Bavli was already accepted by then, but the ordering for the Bavli Masorah in Tveria might already have been determined in an earlier period in their work. I'm going to talk, by the way, you're going to read more about the Bavli Masorah, and maybe that's why they chose to follow a different order. What? Yes. Thomas?
You said that the first reason is because they thought they regarded the Bali specifically.
No, in general. No, they didn't subscribe to the authority. In other words, they didn't consider the Talmud Bavli binding the way we do today, the way they did already by the end of the Gaonic period. And it could have been Eretz Yisrael that had a different tradition. Okay? And therefore they didn't, but the only thing you have is we don't have Yishami that says otherwise, but they may just have had a different tradition. Or maybe been unaware of this tradition as well. Okay. So we'll